Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In 1967, Israel defeated 5 Arab countries in 6 days. It took over the part of Palestine that it had not seized in 1948. As future events have shown, this quick victory greatly increased peace and stability in the region and the world, and help reduce terrorism and anti-Semitism. It was therefore natural for the US government after September 11 to try to duplicate this positive experience, but on a larger scale, in a country not of 3 million, but of 25 million people. In order to achieve this wonderful result, the US government committed the crime which has been condemned in Nuremberg as the first crime, the one that contains and renders possible all the other crimes, namely the crime against peace. Against the explicit wish of the United Nations and of the overwhelming majority of world opinion, they have attacked a defenseless country that posed no threat whatsoever to their security, having been weakened by one of the cruelest embargoes in the history of the world. Moreover, they justify themselves, invoking pretexts that even then were manifestly fallacious and were chosen, as Paul Wolfowitz says, for bureaucratic reasons. What we have to discuss in these 2 days are the intellectual architecture of such a policy. The neoconservative intelligentsia, which has planned through the PNAC and through other think tanks, who have engineered the policy which had led to the war in Iraq. Before engaging in a criticism of the neoconservative ideology and explaining what it means, let me try to underline what is the nature of the crime. After all, these people are intellectuals. They are not, you know, doing war themselves. They are not, all of them at least, not taking decisions directly. They are advocating a certain policy. And so we should focus on what kind of crime that represents. It has been popular nowadays to set up tribunals that judge war crimes, civilians in combat, rape, women, etc. And we have special courts about Yugoslavia and probably tomorrow about Iraq, and sometimes even some political leaders, at least those that the West does not like Milosevic or Saddam Hussein, will appear in front of those special courts. But what is never discussed is exactly what I call the first crime, namely the one against peace, and the intellectual who sort of justify this policy and these crimes. And a similar event occurred, if you wish, in a previous, Professor Uttar was mentioning the Vietnam War. In the event of the Vietnam War, it should not be forgotten that the Kennedy administration brought in as advisors what they called the best and the brightest mind in the country. And these were intellectuals like Robert McNamara, for example, that advocated and planned the war in Vietnam. And there is an interesting remark by Noam Chomsky about those people, which also apply to the neoconservative intellectuals, which makes a difference, which makes the responsibility of intellectuals particularly striking and their action particularly dangerous. If somebody who is very rich, let's say, somebody who owns, you know, companies and so on, works for the government and makes a mistake, he can always admit that he makes a mistake and go back to his private affairs. But intellectuals, because their legitimacy, their social legitimacy is linked to their capacity as experts or so-called experts, cannot so easily admit error. Because if they admit error, they lose all they have. They don't have the background, for example, of a private corporation to which they can return. And these people, therefore, their also legitimacy is the expertise that they provide. And therefore, they are likely, as what happened in the Vietnam War, to not to admit mistake and to encourage a continuation of the policy, even if it's mistaken. Okay. So, the other thing I want to underline is the so-called, some moral dimension, because people are quick to condemn war crimes which are committed by people in battles. But people in battles at least risk their life in a situation of great stress, even if they are in a superior situation. It's a different situation, in my view, at least from a moral point of view, from the people who are working in well, who have a perfectly quiet life, they have nice offices, they have a very comfortable life, and nevertheless, they plan monstrous crimes. And for this, I would like to mention quote John Pilger, who is a British journalist who has been very much involved in criticizing the present policies of the British government. And some time ago, when there was the embargo against Iraq, he received a letter written by the Foreign Office that was justifying the British policy with respect to Iraq. And he quotes a sentence from the letter, which says the following: Saddam Hussein makes sure there are plenty of malnourished children to film for TV. And Pilger adds, I can't really describe the obscenity and offense caused by those words and its effect on those of us who have been to Iraq and have watched children die in front of us and find them everywhere. They die, of course, for want of basic medicines and equipment, thanks largely to policies made in London and Washington. John Davies, the civil servant in charge, has never been to Iraq. The junior official who signed this letter, Jamie Cooper, has never been to Iraq. Robin Cook and Peter Hain and Tony Blair, the moral crusader, have never been to Iraq. Of course, the issue is an old one. It is about those impeccable men in suits who live impeccable middle-class lives and who condemn to death thousands of people at great remove in distance and culture. Kissinger did it when he and Nixon killed 500,000 Cambodians with their illegal bombing. Reagan did it with his illegal attacks on the people of Central America. George Bush did it with his slaughter of Iraqis in 1991, which he called the greatest moral crusade since World War II. We are now facing a new such event, and what I want to turn now to discuss what it means, what is their basic argument, and then raise a certain number of objections. The ideology of the PNAC is rather simple, and you can find it in the documents. It basically starts from one observation, that with the end of the Cold War, the American is the sole superpower and has overwhelming military might. On the other hand, it's a liberal democracy, and as such, it upholds a certain number of values, like human rights, democratic elections, and free markets. And what the United States should do is to use its military power in order to spread those values all over the world. And one thing which is very important for them is that their interests coincide with their values. Namely, it's in the interest of the United States to expand democracy and human rights and free markets all over the world. And it also coincides with their values. So the two coincide, and why not use military force in order to do that wherever other means will fail, like, for example, when facing a hostile regime like those of Iran, Iraq, Syria, Libya, North Korea, and others. The United Nations and international law, for them, is just something that was relevant, maybe, to the era of containment when the United States was facing a much stronger power, namely the Soviet Union. And nowadays, these things are simply not relevant. So if people argue that the United States is violating international law, I suspect my distinguished colleagues from the defense to reply that they miss the point. The point is, of course, the whole structure of international law is part of the problem and not part of the solution, and that has to be changed because the United States, as a benevolent imperial power, will spread those liberal democratic values all over the world. There's something interesting also to understand about the neoconservative ideology, is that it may be neo, but it's not particularly conservative. For example, the neoliberals could be called archaeoliberals. They are reviving ideas that are not new, but are so old that they have been forgotten. They were popular in the 19th century at the time of, you know, laissez-faire free market liberalism. And it's after the catastrophe of the World War I and the 30s that these ideas were repelled, and now they are coming back. So in the sense, they are liberal, but not particularly neo. The conservative, the neoconservative, on the other hand, are neo, but not particularly conservatives. The word used to describe people who were converted from the left, often from the far left, sometimes Trotskyists went all the way from the criticism of Stalinism to the support for Western imperialism and Zionism. And so they are somehow, sometimes, they are not particularly conservative in the sense that they're revolutionaries. They want to upset the whole legal order of the world, and the one they want to change radically the world. In that sense, you don't use the word conservative. For example, there's a well-known left, there are even people whom you might call left on many issues. For example, the British journalist Christopher Hitchens, who used to write in The Nation, has become, he was invited actually to be part of the defense, but he couldn't come. But Christopher Hitchens is somebody who was writing in The Nation, which is a leftist journal in the United States, and he wholeheartedly endorsed both the war against Afghanistan and the war against Iraq in the name of human rights and democracy. He has, by the way, a brother, also named Hitchens, of course, who is a very conservative religious person and a classical conservative who very strongly opposed the war. Pat Buchanan in the United States could be described also as a traditional conservative, and he strongly opposed neoconservative ideology. So one has to know thy enemy, and one has to distinguish and see that in some sense the neoconservative ideology is all the more complicated to discuss because it's not a traditional right-wing ideology, and in many ways it appeals to values and ideas of the left, internationalism, human rights, especially that doesn't dare to speak about socialism anymore will be attracted by this idea of spreading democracy and human rights. Good. So now, what are the arguments? I want to, since I'm in the prosecution, I want to list a certain number of arguments. I won't list them all. I won't go into, since I'm not a more technical things that Karen Parker will probably discuss when she comes. But I want to give my way of responding to the discourse of the neoconservative. First of all, this question that the interest and the values of the United States coincide. Suppose you go to see a used car dealer, and he wants to sell you a car which he says is in good condition, the price is very low, and you wonder why this is so, and even though you don't know him, he says that because he's your friend, and he wants to make you happy. I think you will start to be suspicious, and if you ask what is his interest in doing so, if he replies that his interests and his values coincide, you are going to be very suspicious. My interests tend to be selfish, and the values usually tend to be altruistic. Saying that they coincide is another way to say that one is not selfish, but altruistic. And when people say that, what I like to say is, show me. But show me in deeds, not in words. Otherwise, the charge of hypocrisy cannot be easily avoided. Does the United States cut its farm subsidies in order to have a free market competition between its farmers and the peasants of the third world? It does not. Does it encourage the production of generic medicine in order to fight AIDS and other diseases in the third world? No, it does not. Does it take measures to preserve fuel and take energy conservation measures in order to provide for the future development of third world countries who will need this energy like China and India? No, it does not. Does it participate in international effort in order to prevent climate changes that may have devastating consequences for millions of people? No, it does not. Therefore, the values and nothing in those measures would contradict its alleged values, and so the charge of hypocrisy cannot be so easily dismissed by people who would like to defend the neoconservative ideology. Another point of that one can object is that the source of the conflicts in the world, that the neoconservative see the source of conflicts in the world are bad dictators, religious fanatics, and so on, mostly in the Muslim world, and if only we were spreading democracy and human rights, then conflicts would not arise. I think it's wrong both at the psychological level, at the historical level, and also in a deep socioeconomic sense. Let me explain first in a sort of psychological and historical sense by taking a very simple example, the conflict between Israel and the Palestinians. The oppression that the Israelis are inflicting on the Palestinians cannot be explained by the fact that Israel is not a democracy. As far as its Jewish population is concerned, Israel is fairly democratic. And it's simply, and it could be even a perfect democracy, I don't think it changes anything to the oppression that they're inflicting upon the Palestinians. This is an example which I think shows, and it's very obvious that there are many other examples, that you cannot explain conflict simply by ascribing it to dictatorship. The French were eagerly seeking to recover the Alsace-Lorraine during the period between 1870 and World War I, and that was not due to the fact that it was not a perfect democracy. There is another point, which is, if you look at the bigger picture in the world, Professor Samir Amin yesterday spoke on, described the world as an apartheid system on the world scale. And I think this is maybe the most basic reason why the PNAKA ideology is deficient. I think this expression is quite right if you think that 80% of the wealth in the world is concentrating in 20% of the world population, and of course the 20% remaining of the wealth in the rest. This is of course the result of many causes and many historical events. Colonialism, neocolonialism, cannot be written away from this picture. They play a role which is difficult to quantify, but is undoubtedly there. The problem of the inequality in the resources in the world has several factors. One is the transfer of payments from the south to the north to the so-called debt payment. The other is the constant flow of cheap raw materials from the south to the north, mostly the more important. Another one is the flow of cheap labor. Both here, the availability of cheap labor for Western and Northern companies, both here and in the form of immigrants, and there in the form of multinational corporations finding cheap labor in the third world. There is even transfer of gray matter, because increasingly, and especially in the United States, the third world provides us with intellectuals that make up for the deficiencies of our educational system. All this is a source of conflict which has nothing to do with the issue of democracy. And it's a conflict over control of resources. Over and over again throughout history, people of the third world have tried to develop themselves like the West, like Great Britain did, and then France, the United States, Germany, and others. To do that, they want to control their economic policy. They want to control their resources. They want to control their allocation of resources and their labor forces. And in doing so, the conflict between them and the rich part of the world. This conflict leads people to confuse, and I think that's a basic confusion at the basis of the PNAKA ideology, and I say broader ideology, including in leftist circle, between being democratic and being pro-Western. Countries in the third world, if they were democratic, and when they are really democratic, and the more they are democratic, the least pro-Western they are going to be. Many dictatorships are pro-Western. That's true. First of all, the West has supported many dictatorships. That's often said. But people forget that there have been many democratic movements in the third world that have been subverted by the West and have been anti-West, or rather the West has been anti-them. For example, Arbenz in Guatemala, Goulart in Brazil, Allende in Chile, Lumumba in Congo, the Sandinistas in Nicaragua, Mossadegh in Iran, and Chavez nowadays in Venezuela. All these people have been elected democratically, and all of them have been subverted by the West because of this basic conflict about resources and control of the economy. That's why I think it's totally ludicrous for the Americans to claim that they're going to establish a democracy in the Arab world, especially in Iraq or elsewhere. I think you can take any taxi, and I've not been often in the. You can take any taxi anywhere between Rabat and Damas and speak with the taxi driver about what the Arabs world want, and I think you will see three reasons among others. Maybe the Arabs who are here may contradict me, but I think there are three reasons among others that people want there and that the democratic government will try to implement, but that the United States cannot accept. First of all, get the United States out of the Middle East. No US bases in the Middle East. Very few people want those bases. Number two, allow the Arab states to create an effective military might that could counterbalance what they consider, for very good reason, the Israeli threat. And this, given that Israel possesses nuclear weapons, will also include the possession of nuclear weapons. After all, France and Britain built nuclear weapons to counter what they perceive as the Soviet threat, and when they did that, they were democratic countries. Finally, and maybe more importantly, control the oil prices, the quantity of oil produced, and where the money from the oil goes to. Does it go to the Western banks? Does it go to developing the region? For all these reasons, I don't believe that the US would not only implement a democracy in the Middle East, but it could not tolerate one. What the United States might want and call a democracy is the neocolonial regime that they've been building up in Cuba and the Philippines after a previous event of liberation when there was the Spanish domination and they intervened in those countries and took them over from the Spanish. Another example of the conflict between democracy and the Third World is provided by the TV station Al Jazeera. Not knowing Arab, I don't notice TV, but I noticed that when it started, it was actually applauded in the West for the reason that it was considered as being more democratic than the state-controlled TV of the Arab states. And it was applauded because, again, of this equation, they think it's more democratic, therefore it's more pro-Western. But it turns out that it's not exactly to the liking of the West, to the point that now, if I understand well, the journalists of Al Jazeera are fair game for the American army. I think that the greed and the arrogance of the West, and that's the major problem of the neoconservative, the greed and the arrogance of the West is the main obstacle to the spread of their alleged ideals and values. And far from saying that their interests and ideals coincide, I think they are in great contradiction, as it is for most human beings, there is a contradiction between your ideals and your interests, as the example that I gave of the used car dealers. Hundreds of millions of Muslims now believe, because of the war in Afghanistan and in Iraq, that the Judeo-Christian world is engaged in a war of religious war, a civilization war against their religion. This is the result of the policy that has been advocated by the neoconservative. And it's a major crime that will have lasting consequences on the situation in the world for decades to come. They may be wrong in believing that. It may be that the war is not against their religion, but the fact that they believe it and that they have reason to believe it due to the behavior of the Western power has will have tragic consequences for years to come. We'll have time to discuss arguments against the PNAC, more arguments against the PNAC later, but I want to finish by learning about elaborating a little bit on the consequence of this policy. And one of the consequences of this policy is that it may very well backfire. Things don't go according to plan. They don't go exactly as advertised. American soldiers have been killed. Thousands of others have been wounded. Many are demoralized. Doubt occurs not only in the Iraqi government, but even in the American leadership. They try to reassure themselves by saying, this is not Vietnam. Wait a minute, it's not yet Vietnam. But number of Americans killed already exceed the number of Americans killed in Vietnam during the first 3 years of their intervention there, which one should not forget has started in 1962. One could do other comparisons. The resistance in France and Belgium had not reached a year after the German invasion of 1940. The strength of the Iraqi resistance. That the Americans' liberator provoked more hostility and less collaboration than the German invaders here should create a certain amount of reflection among the people who have supported so-called humanitarian wars and humanitarian intervention, including the neoconservatives. More generally, I think the situation, it's too early to say how the situation in Iraq will evolve. But it may very well be a turning point in the history of the world. As I see it, the last 20 years, with the decadence and the demise of communism and of other movements like the National Liberation Movement, in the third world, has led to what one might call a restoration on the world scale, somewhat similar but on a bigger scale as what had happened in Europe after the defeat of Napoleon and the victory of conservative ideas. This victory, this restoration on the world scale, has held back many of the gains made by third world nations during their phase of national liberation, as well as the gains made since World War II by workers in our countries. It cannot be denied that the United States and its think tank, its ideological weight, the latest episode, have been the light at the top of the hill for the reactionaries all over the world. The United States has a very great symbolic value as the symbol of this reaction and this restoration on the world scale. And to the extent that the United States is forced to lie about its policy in Iraq and is being defeated in the field, or at least put in difficulty in the field, this may have a great psychological and symbolic values. First of all, for the Palestinians, who might be encouraged in their struggle by the difficulties met in Iraq, and I see that even the Israeli government is already aware of that. It may also be encouraging for other people in the world, mostly in Latin America, who are fighting against the terrible consequence of so-called globalization. If, and as I say, it's too early to say, but if the United States get dragged into an unwinnable war, it will be a terrible thing for the Iraqi people, because as I said, they cannot withdraw from a situation which was supposed to show their absolute superiority over the world. That makes the crime of the PNAC even greater, because they have created a situation, as I say, from which they cannot admit that they were wrong, and the United States cannot admit that it was wrong. So, but as I say, this may have indirect positive effect. Since we have called our tribunal the Brussels Tribunal in honor to Bertrand Russell, I would like to quote a passage from Bertrand Russell which I think is quite appropriate to the condemnation of the policy that we are discussing today. It was a very different period. It was something that he wrote about the Soviet Revolution in 1920. And it was a reflection on the situation of another episode of imperial arrogance, namely the attitude that the Western power who had won World War I were having with respect to the former Germany and Austria through the Versailles Treaty, and also the invasions that they did, and the embargo that they did, and also a murderous embargo that they did against the nascent Soviet Republic. Russell writes, "It seems evident from the attitude of the capitalist world to Soviet Russia, of the Entente to the Central Empires, and of England to Ireland and India, that there is no depth of cruelty, perfidy, or brutality from which the present holders of power will shrink when they feel themselves threatened. If, in order to oust them, nothing short of religious fanaticism will serve, it is they who are the prime sources of the resultant evil. To make the transition with a minimum of bloodshed, with a maximum of preservation of whatever has value in our existing civilization, is a difficult problem. I wish I could think that its solution would be facilitated by some slight degree of moderation and humane feeling on the part of those who enjoy unjust privileges in the world as it is." I think the neoconservative intellectual, the PNAC and their supporters in the European intelligentsia benefit from unjust privileges, but they don't show a slight degree of moderation or of humane feeling. Thank you.